we continue. Studying the mystery. Just a little more historical background on Keizan Zenji, the author of the Transmission of Light record. You may have heard this before, but if not, it's nice to know a little bit about Keizan, because we don't bring him up so much compared to Dogen a few generations earlier. We constantly bring up, and this is from Francis Cook's introduction. It's sometimes said that if Dogen is the father of Soto Zen, Keizan is the mother. Without Dogen, there would have been no Soto Zen. He made the hazardous trip to Song Dynasty China and brought back the new teaching and practice. He found a small group of dedicated students who wanted to learn what he had to teach, and thus he started a new religious community. And he founded a Heiji and acquired students such as Ejo, who succeeded him and kept his line going. However, the fact remains that when Dogen died, in 1253, Soto Zen had grown very little physically or in terms of strength. Kind of interesting. During Dogen's life, it was just this small movement. It's true that he died very young at age 53, and thus did not have a long life to build and expand. But the problem was probably not so much a matter of time as it was objectives and motivation. Most of his energy went into writing and teaching, and he probably simply was not interested in expanding his empire. He just enjoyed living in the mountains and in a small community, and wasn't into we gotta bring this all around the world and make a huge Soto Zen movement. Thus, when Keizan became abbot of Daijoji, Dogen's Buddhism was still a small, localized community with few temples and priests. The later growth of Soto to the point where it had a very large number of temples and priests and millions of parishioners, with the corollary power and prestige, was due to Keizan's work and that of his successors. I think earlier here it says, this might be surprising to you, I think this book was written in 1991, so at that time it's probably about the same now. There are 25,000 Soto Zen temples in the world, maybe 100 or so outside of Japan. So basically 25,000 Soto Zen temples in Japan. That seems like a lot. Just to imagine 25,000 temple buildings with more than 30,000 Soto Zen priests and 10 million followers, meaning people who consider Soto Zen their religion. 10 million people.
Wow.
And also I just thought it's interesting that 25,000 temples and 30,000 priests, and generally I think of these 25,000 temples, I think there's like around 20 of them are like what we would call like training monasteries, like, you know, 1% or less, and most are just like one priest living in a temple, often with a family, and maybe having zazen groups, but taking care of the lay community, basically. So there's 25,000 temples and 30,000 priests. There's 5,000 priests who don't have basically like their own temple. So there's, you know, there's probably several hundred in the monasteries. And then I imagine that this other small percentage is like the students of, like, often there's like one student of that temple priest, which is often the son of the family, and they are like apprenticing to be that the temple priest for that place. Keizan himself founded several new monasteries during his lifetime, including Sojiji, which would become the headquarters of his branch of the school, and he left several inspired followers, primarily Dasan Joseki, our ancestor, and Meiho Sotetsu, who spread Soto Zen and continued their teacher's work of building temples and monasteries. However, it would not have been enough to simply build monasteries and temples. It was also necessary to present the faith in such a way as to be attractive to people other than dedicated monks. Dogen's religious vision had to be translated for the masses. Translated for the masses. The Zen that Dogen taught at Eheiji was severe, demanding, uncompromising, and had a purist streak in it. It was not the kind of Buddhism that was likely to attract many people, and probably Dogen did not care much if it did not. And maybe if he did, if that's what he cared about, it would have been a whole different, like, would have a whole different Dogen. And it maybe would be a whole different thing happening. However, Keizan was a different kind of person with a different history, and probably he had a different objective. For one thing, as a young man, he had studied under teachers who flavored their Zen with practices usually associated with other forms of Buddhism, primarily esoteric practices. He practiced with Tendai and Shingon teachers, Vajrayana Buddhism of Japan. So he moved it, which is very ritual oriented, and so he brought in those elements into Dogen's so-called pure Zen. It's not so clear what exactly life was like at Eheiji. I mean, we have a lot of, Dogen did write a lot about it, but he never mentions, for example, I don't think he mentions anywhere, just like daily morning and evening service. They may well have had them, but it's funny that in, you know, thousands of pages of Dogen, he doesn't mention, and he doesn't mention a lot of different ceremonies, although he does mention elaborate ceremonies for opening and closing the practice period, for example, and what we call Nenju ceremony, and some others. And it may just be that he didn't bother to mention them because they were just doing them every day, but sometimes it sounds as if Dogen's temple life was just like zazen continuously without even bothering to stop and chant. He definitely did Oryoki. Our Oryoki style is straight out of Dogen's instructions. These esoteric schools, interestingly, their own approach to religion was pragmatic and eclectic, which differed very much from Dogen's much more purist attitude. We might think of like esoteric would be even less accessible, right, than zazen. I think in America we would probably have this view. More people are attracted to sitting meditation than esoteric ceremonies in America. But maybe in Japan, it sounds like it was kind of maybe the opposite. Zazen's too difficult, actually. That's the super esoteric practice. but ceremonies that have a kind of almost magical elements to them or something, the masses of people have always, in every culture, related to that. I mean, we do. In America, look at how many people attend a church service compared to sitting meditation. If we say that's based on preference, we could say, yeah, the masses like esoteric ceremonies much more than we might think of like practical meditation. Keizan remembered his teachers when he had his own monasteries and incorporated some of these same practices. So, chanting Dharanis, for example, is we could call it a Vajrayana esoteric practice. We maybe think of them as just chant. It doesn't have any special powers, but that is the origin of Dharanis and mantras. Shingon is the literally means mantra. It's the translation of literally means true word, which is the translation of mantra. Keizan also instituted the practice of ministering to the mortuary needs of parishioners. This was something the people had a great need for and expected of the priests, and the result was both a closer bond between temples and parishioners and a great deal of income for the temples. And all of this was greatly instrumental in the growth of Soto Zen. The mortuary needs, and of course this is carried on to today, funeral ceremonies. People need them constantly. People are dying, and we want to honor that in true form. So expanding the practice. Maybe I never heard of Dogen talking about funeral ceremonies, actually. Maybe never did them except for the monks living there. So that began this spreading of Soto Zen to the especially rural Japan, farming villages and so on, where people wanted some spiritual practice that they could easily relate to, and they wanted these life transitions to be taken care of. Yes?
I heard it said that there was Dogen Zen, and then Keizan developed Soto Zen.
Ah.
Soto Zen as we know it today.
Yeah. Keizan is the ancestor of all Soto lineages. And also there's sometimes it's distinguished Dogen Zen and Keizan Zen. It talks about elsewhere in this introduction that Keizan Zen is distinguished by particularly these this emphasis on what we might call Buddha nature. I mean, Dogen brings it up too, but Keizan uses all these terms that imply that there is this, I mean, just in our few chapters we've studied so far, subtle consciousness he talks about. He talks about that one, you know, the Lord of the house, these phrases that are all about particularly like realizing and knowing this nature of mind in a very distinctive way. He kind of talks a little bit more about like, you must realize this. If you don't, you're sunk. This kind of talk is all partly because it's these enlightenment stories that he's going through. But Dogen doesn't talk that way so much. Dogen emphasizes more like those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. And practice and realization, practice and verification are not two. And it's not about a particular dividing line. In a way, maybe we could say that Dogen is emphasizes non-duality, like pure non-duality, more than Keizan, who starts to sound a little bit like there's this you have to realize, and this is not it. A little more dualistic sounding. I hesitate to say that because he often does come back around, always, all Zen teachings always come back around to non-duality. But just a little different emphasis, particularly on that one, it. In the Shasta Abhi translation of the Denko Roku, and Jiyu Kenet Roshi, their founder, notice this tendency that Keizan has all these names for this realm, this subtle consciousness, this Buddha, and every time he uses one, refers to it or that one, she has the translator capitalize it. So all through the book, there's like, through all of Keizan's commentaries, there's all these like capitalized sections. So there's many, many different names that he's using. So it's like, if you want to attain such a thing, you must be such a person. So she put like, such a thing in capital letters.
You said that Dogen was speaking to the initiated and Keizan was speaking to the uninitiated.
Maybe. It seems like to even practice with Dogen was difficult and his rules for Cloud Hall, for their Zendo. He says something like, those who have totally sincere way-seeking mind will be admitted, and if you don't, you can't come in. Kind of like, if you don't have like total bodhicitta, the wish for total Buddhahood, like, don't even bother showing up. So in that sense, he was very kind of, and it was a very small group because of that maybe. And Keizan was maybe more, I think Keizan had different sides too, because in this record, this sounds like he's not talking to the masses, right? This sounds like he's talking to this group in a practice period of people practicing very intently, and he's... He has a very kind of admonishing tone throughout. So he had that side, and then he would also expand to include everyone. And maybe he would, I don't think he would talk this way to the parishioners that would come requesting a funeral ceremony. He wouldn't say, if you haven't reached this realm, you'll be lost forever. No, welcome. Yeah, how can we help take care of you? And,
but the priests would be, in a way, the Kaizen developed Soto Zen. The priests would be speaking to people who were living primarily with dual mind.
Yeah.
Dual language.
Yeah.
So, speaking of the Lord of the house is, and that is a natural language.
Yeah.
As opposed to Dogen, which is not natural language.
Yeah, in a way, I think it's like Dogen is more, maybe, I think it's fair to say, more subtle and difficult to act, actually, at least on the surface, to actually like tap into and work with than Kaizen. It's a little more like straightforward, and also it doesn't play with language in all these weird ways that Dogen does. He's just bringing up the classic Zen stories and talking about them in a pretty straightforward way. So, given all that, we have today's story about Dung An Guan Chu, Do An Kan Chi Da Yo Shu. Remember the. Okay, the previous ancestor was Doan Dohi, so they have the same name, Doan. And it's because they lived at Doan Monastery, so they're, you know, they take the name of their place, like Ahe took his name. The 41st ancestor was Great Master Dung An the Latter. He studied with Dung An the Former. Dung An means uniform peace. He said, Dung An the Latter said to his teacher, quote, "The ancients said, what worldly people love, I love not. I wonder what you love, teacher." And Dung An Daopi said, "I have already gotten to be such." With these words, Dung An Guan Chu was greatly awakened. So now we have a case about the world. Worldly people, literally like in Chinese, it says also world people. And they use that character in the same way that we talk about worldly. And I just, what does that mean, actually? And I just looked in the dictionary just before coming. Worldly says concerning pursuits in the world as opposed to spiritual matters. Worldly. So, interesting, because that's a very dualistic definition, right? Pursuits in the world, because isn't the whole point of spiritual practice of any kind to benefit the people of the world? So, what do we mean by this? As we chanted at the beginning of the talk, we vow with all beings to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, that upon meeting it, we shall renounce worldly affairs. and maintain the Buddha Dharma. It says there in Chinese, renounce, let go of world Dharma, maintain Buddha Dharma.
Sentience?
Yeah, we vow to renounce sentient affairs and maintain the teaching of the non-sentient. Yeah, I could say it like that. And renounce is a big one too. It's a big term. Yes.
I think what I found most challenging is having children, I'm really attached to them, and they suffer, and then that generates a lot of suffering in me, and a lot of strong desire to want to alleviate their suffering. And I have, there's not a lot in the literature about parenting. Hasn't got to that yet. Maybe that's something Americans can do, that we can do. But that's definitely a difficult place. It's sort of when you're talking about the eight winds of the world, blowing us off our seat. You know, I was just for me, it's nearly always to do with children and me as a mother wanting to protect them from suffering. And am I doing enough? And how do I do it? And that feels very. I find that very hard to hold those sorts of worldly concerns in my practice.
Yeah,
it disrupts my practice. But I can't not have those worldly concerns. It wouldn't be appropriate if I said, they'll have to figure out their own lives.
Yeah, I know.
I find it quite hard.
Yeah, how do you totally integrate that and take care of it? And is there a way to take care of children in a not worldly way, the way that we're looking at it, with great love? I also think of when you...
That's exactly the thing.
Yeah.
How can I be a practitioner and care for my children and keep some kind of peace of mind amidst the sort of...
I think this is, big American Zen koan. And when you just said, we don't have any stories in the literature, any teachings about child raising from a Dharmic point of view, I just thought of when you said that, because we brought it up yesterday. Well, we do this one Zen story, kind of, about child raising. Do you remember?
Yeah.
The one about Hakuin, right?
Yeah.
And in a way, you could say it applies. It's in the sense that, here, you take this kid and raise him, and the circumstances may be different than our usual circumstances of parents and children, but his answer may be the key of child raising, right? He just said, "Is that so? Okay." we don't know. Maybe he got really attached to that kid and then had to give it away again.
That's right. What if in the story the taking away of the child was going to cause the child terrible pain?
Yeah.
How would he have dealt with that?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that so becomes not this, yeah.
Yeah, as that so doesn't have to be aloof. But it might look more aloof than our usual responses, or less ensnared. Yes.
I'm not qualified to speak as a mother, clearly. But I wonder, what's called for is an intimacy without attachment. And by attachment, I mean a trajectory that we conceive of and hope for or hope not for. But the practice of being totally present and appropriate to that entity's being at that moment may require a faith in that process that the trajectory will be beneficial, as opposed to stepping back and wondering if the trajectory is right or wrong or whatever. That total presence, that manifestation of presence, of Buddha nature in the present, is sufficient. And our best efforts to be appropriate are sufficient.
Yeah, it's all about intention. In each circumstance, each moment, different. You know, even if it's a long-standing familial relationship, still we need it in the moment, and what's the appropriate response now. I think another thing in this brief story is this word love. I think this is a question too. What worldly people love, I don't love. What do you love? So just looking at the Chinese, it's, or the Japanese character is pronounced I, and this character, it means love and kind of like particularly sort of like sentimental or affectionate love. And so it can have a positive quality, but in Buddhist texts, traditional texts, that character is usually used in a negative sense to mean like attachment. Although maybe love is the most common translation, and because of that, I see in our modern culture where you can get like T-shirts and various items with Chinese characters on them. I see a lot of people, a significant amount of people, with that character of I on their shirts or hats or packs or stickers or
tattoos.
I have seen this tattoo. Yeah, exactly. And I always think when I see it, because I know it from this Buddhist sense of like, it makes me kind of like stand up a little straighter, kind of like, oh yeah, some renunciation. Like, oh, this is like, it's kind of like the world. It's a display of the world. And just because probably the people who make the T-shirts are like, let's make a love shirt. And they just look in the dictionary and it says love, so they put that character. But we have another character, G, pronounced in Japanese, that also means love. If I was making a T-shirt, I would use that one. And that one translates the Sanskrit Maitri or Pali Metta. Yes. So it may have that, it definitely, and in Buddhism a lot of the characters have kind of a different connotation than the general public connotation. There are other characters, quite a few, in Buddhist terms that literally mean attachment and grasping. Usually this one isn't used specifically for like upadana. But it's particularly kind of like in that kind of romantic, maybe worldly kind of love. And this other love or loving kindness, can be applied within like a kind of a family situation or something. I think. What do you think would be the difference between worldly love and Buddha's love?
Did you say that there's no character that actually expresses like a romantic type of love? So, yeah, that would be the
Well, I think this one maybe would, if there's any, this would be the one, this I character.
But the language people will tell you that
not. Oh, okay, okay.
That it has come to be used that way.
I see.
But it doesn't really mean that.
So what would they say?
The professional will say, well, don't you love people? Mm.
Yeah.
Which makes, like, the Greeks have three different words for love. I can think of two of them right now. One is agape, right, which is like this kind of loving kindness, unconditional love, you know. And then I think the other one is eros.
Philos and eros.
Okay. Eros, which is kind of like this romantic, you know, kind of more sexual. So I would, when you're saying, you know, loving kindness or the Buddha's type love, all inclusive love, avocado with the Greeks, kind of a deeper, there's more of a depth to it.
And I think again, we shouldn't divide it into, we have this one kind for our children and spouses, and then we have this kind for the world. I think we can relate to children and spouses and so on with, it's maybe not completely, eliminating this so-called romantic kind of love, but it's also including the big, big love, maybe we call it. Maybe we call it big love and small love. and I think another way to define the difference could be just, maybe from a kind of practice point of view, is like love that wants something for ourselves versus love that's just like purely giving. And the joy of just loving someone just as they are. And I think this is naturally, there's that, the mother has that kind for their child, like even if the child's really upset and like screaming at the mother doesn't start hating the child, I would imagine. So it's kind of like, it's deeper than the worldly activities of screaming and you're late for school and all this stuff that's annoying in the world. But I think that they may be not so like, it's this one or this one. They can be mixed together. And then can we find, I think maybe this is our challenge. This is in this Western Zen koan, is can we find this way in just like everyday activities of close relationships to keep trying to tap into this deeper selfless love. It's actually, of course, much more rewarding and joyful than selfish love. But in our culture, the self. Self-serving love is so celebrated and so emphasized. It's hard to even remember there's another one.
I've been looking a lot, I touched this the other day, at pinching, which I'm calling wholehearted mind. I saw, I don't know what I looked like, but I saw a little gesture, and I'm wondering, the shin have any place in
it? It does, yeah, it's part of the character. It's part of both I and G, the loving kindness character, both have that heart mind.
So the concatenation of heart mind and shin entails something about being present fully.
more titillated, more gain-oriented.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really comes down to, I mean, romance is a beautiful thing, but I think that where the practice point there is like, are we like really trying to get something for ourselves, like even at the expense of the other? I mean, that's the extreme cases, is like, you know, we don't even really care what happens to the other person, or we do in just some really superficial way.
We really respect the candy.
Yeah, well, I think love in English is, I think that's a good example of how we use love, of like, I really deeply love you, heart to heart, and we use the same word for, yeah, I love chocolate bars. I love ice cream, or as I said yesterday, I love thinking. We just mix them together. But yeah, I, yeah, that kind of attached love, and it's such a difficult area. how do we work with this? Like, my partner and I are separated for maybe 3 years. Not a small matter. We'll probably see each other some in there too. But large part of maybe what might be 3 years, and we have plenty of attachment for each other, and but really, actually, when we started the relationship as two home leavers, we thought, there's some love here. Let's explore this. Let's see how we can help each other to practice. But let's, you know, make sure that we always, in this relationship, put our practice first, which means, like, if somebody feels their aspiration to go practice in some other place, then, like, let's try to support them. And so that's what we're trying to do. And if we remember that, it's very happy. I have a very warm, loving feeling, letting her go, follow her practice heart in another country. So that it constantly shifts back and forth, and then I can get into the needy eye and be like, well, what do you mean 3 years? And I confess that I just got a very expensive plane ticket to Kathmandu for this winter. And it was a struggle. It was, but for both of us, many conversations, a struggle. I feel like, this is really hard to justify this in terms of Dharma. We don't need to do this. We talk on Skype already. And so it was a struggle. It still feels like a struggle after. Still feel like some question: is this appropriate, beneficial to us and all beings? I don't know. So it's a question, right? To continuously study.
It
totally relates to this.
I was reminded this morning that I break rules. That's a shame. I agree.
And you sometimes move cushions when the sun gets
there. Sometimes I move cushions when the sun gets there. I do this. What people might see as that thing may be only half right, because when I do something like that, I'm doing it from the perspective of Shishin practice. What's it like to read of that, from this perspective, as opposed to just occupying some time or just conventionally obsessing about this or that, what's it like to encounter the same thing, conventional thing, but from this point of view?
Yeah, and it is different. I agree. You can, after many days of sashin, you can read one sentence of like a cookbook or something and be like, oh,
exactly,
that's right. Amazing.
Exactly right. So it's like, it's not bifurcated. It's not like, okay, I'm going to suspend sashin for 20 minutes and do that instead. It's, because this time my sashin is specifically dedicated to the whole business of commitment. Some of the things I'm doing, I did when I wasn't so committed. But seeing them through this lens is a transformative experience.
So I would say, yeah, it's interesting practice exploration to see what it's like to read in this container of sashin. And it's also an interesting practice to see what it's like to not do that, right?
Yeah.
And maybe you could say you have some of each because you're not reading continuously. But I think that's how one way to look at the sashin guidelines is, you know, everything's interesting in a way in sashin, but it's so rare to have the chance where we really turn off all these different outlet valves. And then maybe it's back and forth. Like sometimes it's like, well, let me check out what it's like this time. And then the next time we maybe have that urge, it's like, well, no, let's not go with that this time. Let's see what it's like to actually really just see what it's like to not do anything now. So I think there's benefits in all of that. But I was also thinking about this case in particular, since it's so much about attachment, that sashin, if we explore this realm of what is attachment and how do we work with it, sashin is almost, you could say, designed to a magnifying glass focusing in on all our attachments by basically taking away all these opportunities to go with our usual way. So in Orioki, I thought, we don't do Orioki that much, but it's nice to keep refining the form of Orioki practice. It's a great one, right? In so many ways for showing attachment, because for one thing, it involves food. It's one of the classic things we can either a little bit more, a little bit less, a little bit more that or that, a little bit more salt, a little bit more sugar, a little less. Everyone has preferences around food, so how beautiful to just receive what comes and in as neutral a way as we can. And then and it's beautiful to watch the room full of people do this practice. Of course, it's always struck me as in a maybe kind of attached, aesthetic sort of way. It's a beautiful dance to watch. It's like watching a dance performance or something. It's kind of, I have some worldly feelings around watching Orioki. I love it. But here's some little practices, kind of details that with this form you can work with. And I know that it's done differently in all different practice centers. And even at San Francisco Zen Center that we base our form on, it's often, the details are always changing there too. And probably in Japan they're changing too. But the basic thing stays the same. So one that might be different in different ways, and I think I've even heard maybe it's been done different ways here, but I checked with the Eno about her current understanding, and I think that if it hasn't been the case, let's try it this way. She thought that this is the way it's been, as long as she can remember, where after we're, if you receive seconds, before eating the seconds, wait for everybody to be served seconds, and then the servers bow, and then we bow and start eating the seconds. Like in Japan, the way I learned it was you could just start right away. But I think it's a nice thing to look at, like, well, we already have it at the beginning. You know, you're served all this food, it's hot, and then you just wait there, and you're not, we're used to just, when the food comes, you eat it. But we wait, and then we chant, and then finally we get to eat. And so it's just a little bit more, we're already into the meal, but then we wait for the seconds. You can keep eating the firsts. And then another little one that's like maybe never given any instructions, I think I've just thought of this on my own, is this great moment. I think this great moment for noticing like feelings and attachments and body and mind. There's, I think, a lot of moments, but one I've noticed is when we're receiving the food in the second bowl, to pass the bowl, and then we're waiting gassho, and it's different than the other bowls that we're holding out. We're just kind of like, there's not so much room for moving around. We're holding it a little bit over the pot. But for that second one, it's like we've kind of relinquished control over our bowl. We've given it away. and all we have left is just a gassho. And I notice, that there's a tendency to kind of like, we give away the bowl, and then maybe we forget to be in gassho, or we're in gassho, but we're kind of like this, like, you know, like, we're right in there, like, not too much, not too little, and, you know. And so I think it's a great practice, just, and in general, the posture during eating, it's easy to, like, when we're really chowing down, to kind of like... That zazen posture, and lift the bowl like right up here, but that second bowl to when the server's got it, I try to like just sit upright. You could say like one kind of attachment. Another way to talk about attachment is kind of like leaning into things or leaning away from things. That's, you know, mentally, but also physically. So the zazen posture of uprightness is we're not leaning into the future, retreating from the past, or towards or away from any situation. So that's a nice one. But very detailed. It's probably never would get mentioned in or yogi instructions. But it's way down there, you know, way over there, that bowl. And I'm just going to signal over here, and I trust that they're going to see me. Sometimes if I think it's a new server, they might not. I may be like that. So make sure they see. But kind of like, no, you've got it, and like, I trust you. I will signal you. We're doing this together. And when it comes back to me, it will come back to me. Here it comes.
I have a question.
Yes.
When it comes back to you, do you hold it and then bow, or do you set it down?
You can hold it, and actually the second bowl is a nice way to pass it, is you, instead of holding it, like your other bowls you hold on the side like this, the second one you can with three fingers, if your fingers are big enough, hold it like this, and then the server receives it with three fingers. So like this, and then they receive it like this. It's kind of nice when you're passing something where you don't have to get your hands all tangled up together. The way I've learned gamasho passing in San Francisco way is use two hands, so your hands do get kind of, you have to negotiate your hands when you pass the gamasho. but this one is like this, and the server is like this. Also, their fingers then don't touch the germs that you've left around the lip of your bowl. It's a hygienic thing, too. So they serve like this, and when they give it back to you, you take it like this, and then you can steady it on the bottom, and you can bow like this or on the side. But it's like, instead of like, for the second bowl only, it's like this. Like this. And, as you may know, the first person in the pair puts their bowl down, and the second one holds it. And a lot of these things are like, you can see, there's all these details, we just have to memorize it. But the more you do it, the more you start to see that almost all of them have meaning. And they're about very, very subtle harmony of the flow of this interaction of serving and being served. So my understanding of that is like, this person has received it, they have time, they don't need to do anything, so they can put their bowl down or wait in gassho. And the second person, after they serve it, if everything's flowing just right along, the server, as soon as they serve that, they just get right up and they bow. And if this, and you can watch this, if this person takes the time, so it's just about, 5 or 6 seconds to put it down, they'll miss the gassho. So that's the reason for it. The second one bows like this and then puts it down. Another little one that maybe almost no one has even heard is the way I learned is when you, after you you wash the first bowl, you pour the water, you move the stick down, and then you actually hold the bowl. Because you don't, you need to bother putting it down for like a few seconds where you get the cloth and then picking it up. Often we do things with two hands, but this is a case where you actually hold with one hand because you're about to do something with it. Then you find the cloth and then you dry it. It's a little thing, but it's almost like, I think of a lot of Oryoki forms as like pure efficiency. It's like everything is just the right amount of like movement where there's nothing extra and nothing lacking.
Isn't that what Oryoki means?
Yeah, just the right amount.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. Particularly in terms of like, it holds just the right amount of food, which is kind of like a Zen thing too, because it might be a lot or a little, but it's always just the right amount. And those bowls are designed for just the right amount.
There's another one that I find particularly challenging, which is spoon for Buddha ball only.
The tradition, in a like a maybe a Heiji, and Tassajara depends on the abbot. Abbot Ryushin, Paul Haller, is very into this, like you never use the spoon in the second or third bowl. So you have a thick liquid soup or applesauce. That's the worst, I think. Yogurt and applesauce. black beans, yeah. So in Japan, they often wouldn't have these things, right? It's like, it's either like miso soup often, where it's like liquid and solids, and that works really well with chopsticks to eat the solids and drink the liquid. But these thick, gooey things, you're getting it all over your mouth. Go right ahead. Yeah. But I haven't even been doing that here. I've been using spoon, and my teacher uses spoon in the second bowl. How about Catherine Thanis? She used the spoon's fine. So
for the second bowl.
We hereby decree that the Gyokuonji temple form is you may use, when appropriate, the spoon in the second or third bowl. But if it's more appropriate to use the chopsticks, but it's just kind of like you're not so proficient with chopsticks, then use them. We also say don't mix any of the bowls unless the tenzo invites you, I think, right? So the hard one for me is nuts and fruit. They're so nice to mix. Sometimes the tender just like, that's their intention when they put that on the menu, but they just forgot to announce it. Again, we're at their mercy. But we can't assume that. If they don't announce it, we just separate.
The worst is when Tenzo offers, for lunch, offers pasta in the first bowl, so it'll be bow tie pasta or something in the bowl for the grain. And then
tomato sauce.
And then like a blended chard soup or kale soup, some kind of blended soup with greens, or any kind of soup that's meant to have shredded cheese, which they also serve as a second condiment. But then according to the rule that you can only put gamasu in your Buddha bowl, excruciating not being able to put shredded cheese.
Thank you for your confession. So isn't it great? We see that Oryoki is a great practice for working with attachments. And you know, and the nice thing is it's not like it won't permanently damage us. It's only 5 days.
This is so great. I'm learning so much about Oryoki right now. I had no idea I had so much control over the second bowl.
Yeah.
I'm tempted to walk away with it now.
As a server, you mean?
Yeah, but that's so interesting because you know, you never even think about what people are thinking about during Oryoki. You're just doing the job. That's all you're doing. And yet, as you've indicated, there are all these subtleties, both in the mind of the served and the server, but in the actions that kind of go by you that you would not know.
Yeah. Another one is like the server wants to make the best offering to the people. And I think we generally have the instructions like for soup that has like liquid and solid matter in it, you kind of try to stir it frequently. You try to get a really average to thick scoop for the first one. Thick meaning like you're kind of digging down to the bottom, but not completely. Like 3/4 thick. Yeah. And then the second one is like 3/4 liquid, maybe something like that. That's how people have heard. You know, so you want to get, we'll make sure you get to the solids, but then you want to mix in the liquid. And of course, people could have all different preferences with that. There is, might be like, I really just want the liquid, or I really just want the solid. And it's like, you know, you can be calculating the percentages that they're scooping there. And maybe as the soup swirled, you see like one just like lovely chunk of tofu swirling around. They just missed it. Or the salad yesterday had all those tomatoes and just a few precious avocados. I'm like, yeah, I got the tomatoes already. Like, don't you see there's avocados over there?
That's not saying this right.
She actually said it?
She just said it before you said it.
I mean, I have heard sometimes that, like, Tassajara, it will break down and people will go so far as to whisper, avocado.
I had a couple of people point at the avocado. It was quite clear what
they were. Very spoiled.
So these are the great, again, subtleties. Is it that big a deal to point? But, like, the intense renunciation of not pointing. Right? Where do we get a chance to practice like that, you know, other than Oryoki?
But when I was Henzo, I intentionally made an effort to make really fancy food to violate the whole premise of simplicity. But in conjunction with Dogen's wondering what it was like for those who were there for that to have fancy food as opposed to plain food. How did it challenge the practice?
I don't know if it was always fancy. I remember like a grass broth soup that was basically just water with some grass floating in it.
Yeah, it was a third bowl. Yeah, I sanded water with peach juice and then put in stems of parsley and cilantro. It was a mess.
Kind of in response to that, but just in general about the whole renunciation, and then, you know, hearing from Alex and others that have spent months being monks, I just go, in 5 days, I don't want to fly. No, it's really not. It's funny visiting Tassajara, you know, it's like it would bring people chocolate bars, and it would be such a big deal when it's months and months and months. But for us, you know, it's a nice practice, and I do notice, you know, things go by and likes and dislikes. But truthfully, when you talk for 5 days, all good.
Ideally, yeah, we can. That's a nice thing about having a, you know, just a 5 day session. We can, or 7, or 14. That's, I think, the thing about, like, because it's just a short time where we really enter into this. That was my heartache I was trying to express yesterday. I'm like, can we just for these 5 days throw the dead bodies under the tongs and just really let go of all of it, and then we'll take it up again at the other end. Yes? What were you?
I wanted to say something else about the rule, because in the guidelines, more in the vein of confession, because I would say it took me 3 or 4 years to even notice. So here's the list of rules. I hear the list of rules, you know.
But they don't apply to you.
It's probably, some of them do, the ones that I sell to you. I mean, I really didn't even notice it. It's always said to stay in the park. Mm-hmm. But since I was going to go either on a long walk or downtown to get coffee, I just did that. I didn't consider it breaking the rule. You know, it's like, kind of, and I think it's, I can see it very lightheartedly, but I can also see that I do that everywhere. I do it with precepts. It's like, okay, here's my precept, and I define it in a certain way, how I'm going to practice with it, what I'm choosing to challenge myself with. I did that about leaving and, the area. The other one is slipping my mind. Unconscious. I'm going to take this in, and I'm going to decide. I'm going to make this one invisible.
Conveniently overlooking the ones that are actually maybe the most challenging. Uh-huh. Yeah. And again, you know, I wouldn't maybe call it rules as much as, I think guidelines is a pretty good word, because maybe just a way to like see them as gifts. It's not like any of these things are bad to do. It's not like it's bad to leave the park, but they're just, one way to look at it anyway, is they're just to show us our attachments. That's all, you know. They maybe have other convenient things, like actually it generally helps to keep this like strong container, to not go into town and so on, because there's a whole different energy going on. So there are, of course, they're based on practical things, but you could look at them as like whether or not they make any sense. I think that's the thing, is we could say, well, this, it doesn't apply to me because I don't get distracted in town, so I don't need that one. But then you can say, well, it doesn't matter even why they're the way they are. It's just like, how do we, you know, how do we notice our tendencies around them? And even if, and maybe it's not, you could say maybe not even a matter of breaking or not breaking. It's just like, when we break, so-called break, do we notice like, oh, I really wanted to do that. And I see how I like rationalized and justified all the ways that, to kind of feel like, you know, it was fine. Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, precepts too. Mm-hmm. All right.
Scofflaw.
Like one's rules.
Yeah.
In the past. So, Dungan, the latter, studied with the former Dungan. He said, the ancients said, what worldly people, people of the world, love, or, you know, love in a clingy kind of way. I don't love in a clingy kind of way. I wonder what you love in a clingy kind of way. Dungan Daopi said, I have already gotten to be thus. It's emo again. And with these words, the Dung'an was greatly awakened. I wonder what you love. I have already been able to be like this, or I have already gotten to be thus. The master's name, Dungan, was Quan Chur, insight, aspiration, Kan Chi. His biography has not been recorded in detail. He studied with the former Dungan, and his realization was deep. So there's a series of ancestors now where, like, there's almost nothing about them. No stories, no details about their lives. So you almost have this feeling that, like, you know, Dungshan was this just great figure in the lineage. He has a, even we have in English, the record of Dungshan, hundreds of stories about him. A lot we know about him, but then it's almost like that the lineage got kind of like more obscure and was just weaving through these few obscure people for some generations here. Until maybe Fuyo Dokai kind of was a reviver, and it kind of grew again. So when the former Dung'an was about to die, he entered the hall and said, so his teacher was about to die, he said, in front of the shrine of many children, an ancestral child excelled. What about what occurred before Wu Lao Peak? So it's kind of obscure. But the shrine of many children, where an ancestral child excelled, we do know is about, there's a story that Mahakashyapa, the first Indian Zen ancestor, according to tradition, met, well, here in Mahakashyapa's story here, that Mahakashyapa met the world honored one, the Buddha, in front of the shrine of many children. It was just some, like, shrine in India named that. And when the world honored one said, welcome, monk, Ehi Bhikkhu, his hair fell off as a result. He shed his earthly body and he was miraculously clothed in a monk's robes. Also, he was entrusted with the treasury of the true Dharma eye by the Buddha. So, when they first met, and this is how according to our Indian records now, the first ordination ceremonies of the Buddha, he was also not so into ceremonies. Just really, just keep it all simple. So the ordinations were like, someone would come and say, I want to join your order. You just say, welcome, monk. And that was the ordination for some time until, and then the Sangha started growing and growing, and as it started growing, they started adding more forms and ceremonies naturally, starting with, taking refuge in the three treasures was the next version. Just that was constituted an ordination. But first it was just, welcome, monk. There's no precepts for reading that for the first, I forget how many years, 20 years or something, of the Buddhist Sangha. They didn't have any precepts. People were just like totally into practice, and everyone was like living completely ethically and harmoniously and beneficially. And as it got bigger and bigger, like, trouble began. Like, I think we need some rules. So, but the interesting part, one interesting part I think here is that with the Mahakashyapa first met the Buddha, the Buddha said, welcome, and that was it. He received the treasury of the two Dharma eye, and then later, much later in their life together, the Buddha held up the flower and Mahakashyapa smiled, and we say that was the first transmission. But this is kind of implying that the treasury of the true Dharma eye was received when they first met. And then the later part was like just a reenactment. And in Dogen's life, it was the same way. Dogen first met his teacher, Ru Jing, the first time he went in to see him. And Ru Jing said, face-to-face transmission has now occurred. And they practiced together for years, and later they did a formal ceremony to acknowledge that. And in this spirit, without getting into the details of it, in even modern Soto Zen Dharma transmission still keeps this spirit. So it's like the beginning of the week-long of ceremonies, there's a very simple, just like meeting, and that's considered to be the actual Dharma transmission. And then you begin all these very complicated ceremonies and everything that is just kind of like icing or just like celebrating this very simple meeting. I think maybe that's based on maybe this original Mahakashyapa story. In front of the shrine of many children, an ancestral child excelled, meaning at that first meeting, Mahakashyapa kind of stood out and received this transmission. What about what occurred before Wu Lao Peak? And someday someone will do a fully annotated translation here and research this stuff, because none of the translations know what this is about. What Wu Lao Peak is, there's like five old peak, or five elder peak. So, it could be one translation. One Thomas Cleary, in his usual liberal translation style, says, "What about the case of the Zen founder?" So maybe he knows that there's something about this five old peak that's something to do with Bodhidharma. I thought, well, maybe that sometimes they call these the first six ancestors of Zen, are kind of like special ancestors named by their number. So maybe this the first five ancestors of the, after Bodhidharma, the first Chinese five ancestors through Huainong, the five elder peaks in the lineage. Or maybe it's just the name of the mountain peak at the temple where they're standing at the time, which in some ways maybe that would be the most make the most sense here. So this former Dungan was about to die. He entered the hall and said, "In front of the shrine of many children, an ancestral child excelled. What about what occurred before U Lao Peak, or Five Elder Peak?" He said this three times, but no one responded. Maybe they didn't respond because, like, what is he talking about, the Five Elders Peak? Again, in front of the shrine of many children, this ancestral child, Mahakashyapa, began this lineage. What about what occurred before Wu Lao Peak? Finally, Dungan Quanzhir, his student, stepped forward and said, "They stand in the bright night in orderly rows outside the curtain. Their singing is heard for 10,000 miles, expressing the great peace." Dungan, the former, said, "This donkey will get it." After that, the latter, Dungan, remained at Mount Dungan and was called Dungan the Latter. So this poem, I think, actually is quite beautiful. If I hear it as about the ancestors, like the lineage of ancestors, which he's kind of questioning him about, right? It's like in this shrine, the original Mahakashyapa came forth. What about this mountain peak? And he answers, "They stand in the bright night, the bright night." They, I envision all these ancestors standing in the bright night, the night where nothing can be distinguished, but very bright, light shining everywhere, nothing to grasp. They stand in the bright night in orderly rows. Part of the transmission is they a form gets passed down. They stand in rows and chant the Heart Sutra together. Outside the curtain, I think I mentioned, thought of that image the other day of, it's like we have the bright night of Buddha nature, and it's like, but it's blocked from us by this curtain. We have to like pull aside the curtain or raise the curtain. So these ancestors stand in the bright night. You might think that they've just gone totally wild outside the curtain, because inside the curtain is usually where things are very ordered and structured. We might think outside the curtain, there's no forms or conventional designations of any kind. But they stand in the bright night in orderly rows outside the curtain. Their singing is heard for 10,000 miles, expressing the great peace. A poem. Keizan says, "In front of the shrine of many children, an ancestral child excelled," means that the encounter between Shakyamuni Buddha and Mahakashyapa took place in front of the shrine of many children. Once they met, the robe and dharma were transmitted. Later, Mahakashyapa practiced the 12 kinds of austerities. You know them? The Buddhist list.
Number 13.
Ah! Do you know the 13?
Not in order, but let's see if I can.
Wow, this is an obscure list.
Only eating one meal a day.
That's one of them, yeah.
Only eating the food you get on alms round, as opposed to eating a meal that you're invited to by a donor. living at the foot of a tree or somewhere outside, or are those two?
I think there's a few. I haven't looked at this for a while.
A couple of them are they're not contradictory, but like it'd be impossible to do both of them at the same time.
That's true.
Like one of them is like living at the root of a tree, another one's like living in an open field.
Uh-huh.
Wearing robes that you may have seen out of bags.
It's about five. How many robes?
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, only having three robes.
Well, you get the idea.
Not lying down.
That's one of them, yeah. Yeah.
Or like not really sleeping. Yeah. Like only kind of like, you know, like half and half maybe.
So yeah, there may be some more about yeah, they're generally like the things what we're talking about attachment today. They're the thing we tend to like without even thinking about it. They're just the things that all humans have some, you know, we think we have some needs around, particularly food, clothing, shelter, and sleep.
Other than the medicine, there's various interpretations, like only using medicinal herbs, like only medicine you use are medicinal herbs or roots that you forage. I've also heard an interpretation of this, like only using medicinal roots and herbs that you forage that are pickled in urine.
There is a practice of actually using urine as medicine. I mean, it's an ancient health thing. Yeah, so that's amazing you got that many. It warms my heart a little just that somebody bothered to study the 12 or 13 austerities, because when I was your age, I was really into that. I had it memorized, and I would try them out. But they're basically, yeah, they're taught by the Buddha, and they're like, they already have 250 precepts, and they're like, for people who are like, well, can't you give us some more practices? Like, this is too, my attachments are too deep. I need some more structure here. So the Buddha said, these are the 12 or 13 in some lists permitted because, there were a lot of other austere practices going on in India in those days, and there were some things that were harmful to body and mind. So my understanding is the Buddha was a middle way guy. These might not sound so much like middle way, but they're healthy, generally healthy practices that are not like cutting your body apart and things like that. And the Dutanga, it is the Dutta practices in Sanskrit, literally means like shaking up. The practice is to shake up our attachments. They don't like, it's not about like it's better to do them. It's just like they just as we've been talking about, exact same thing as Sesshin guidelines are like our very simple Dutanga practice. Just not leaving the park. It's okay. You can even lie down in the park.
My understanding is that Mahakshapa was the foremost in the aesthetic practices.
Yeah.
That was one of his titles, where like each monk, or each one of the elder monks had like a title like foremost in meditation, foremost in teaching. Mahakshapa,
yeah.
Foremost in aesthetic.
So it's interesting that he was acknowledged as the founding Zen ancestor. probably historically after the fact. So there's, whether we like it or not, there's some connection to the Zen tradition from the very beginning with this, like, really, like, I like to say letting go. Renunciation is a big word, but, and, you know, never lying down is a big thing. But just, if you look at all of that, it's just like, anything I'm holding on to just totally just die to what, everything I think I have to do to, like, maintain this self. Just, like, going beyond what seems like the conventional. So, yeah, that's why it's mentioned, because later Mahakashyapa practiced the 12 kinds of austerities. Later he shared the Buddha's seat. Although he was not present at the death of the Buddha, the entire community was entrusted to him. This is what's meant here by an ancestral child excelled. Now, Dungan Daopi was the legitimate spiritual grandson of Dungshan. So the tradition of Qing Yuan's family flowed back to here. In order to reveal his legitimate spiritual son when he was about to die, he asked, what about what occurred before Wu Lao Peak? He asked this way 3 times, but none of the monks understood, so no one answered. Mount Sumeru stands out lofty among the other mountains. The orb of the sun shines bright before the many beings. Therefore, they stand in the bright night in orderly rows outside the curtain. Truly no one could compare with Guang Chur. Because he was liberated and independent, he had no second. There's not a speck of dust for 10,000 miles. Where now are the clever officials and fierce generals? Singing, singing, all is the great peace. This is the wonderful patchrobe monk. He who studies will find it for the first time when he reaches this realm. I think it's great to study attachment. Such fun. One time I was really, I just felt like I can't move, I can't do anything without attachment. Of, you know, in some way, everything is just, it's just permeating every activity. And I was getting really like distraught about this. I'm like, I don't even know if I can go on, because it's just like, how can there be any, how can freedom ever be possible? This, you know, attachment so deep and all-pervading. And, like, how could you actually have a sip of water without just, like, total grasping attachment? I asked my teacher once in a session. And he said, it's possible to have a sip of water without any attachment. He didn't say two sips. But maybe that's possible too. That's our question for today. Again, these bodies and minds that this one is dwelling in for just a little while here. All these aches and pains, these clinging. clunky bones, sore joints, thoughts of yesterday and tomorrow. All that stuff swirling around. Non-sentient. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.